Welcome to the next podcast of Millen Info. I'm your host, Lauren Ritchie. It's wonderful to have you here joining me for this episode of Millen Info. I hope you've been enjoying the series. I was reflecting on what the series is doing, and for me, it's bringing some amazing world-leading milliners into, well, my ears and conversations, but hopefully your workroom. So I hope you've been enjoying the series that we've been bringing you. Today is no exception, and we welcome Anne Tumlin into the podcast series. Thank you to our wonderful podcast sponsors for their support of this series. These include Hatblocks Australia, Louise McDonald Milliner, House of Adorn, The Hat Magazine, Hatters Millinery Supplies, Lifted Millinery, Be Unique Millinery, Judith M Supply House, Hats by Lico, Hat Academy, and Millinery Australia. Thank you so much to our podcast sponsors for their support of this series. It would not be possible without them. I hope you've been enjoying this series, and I love bringing you these conversations. Please enjoy this episode with Anne.
Thank you so much for joining me, Anne. It's wonderful to have you on the Millinery Info podcast to chat about millinery and your book and so many other projects. Thank you for joining us today.
Well, it's been an absolute pleasure to be invited. Thank you. I've been following the podcast for a number of years. Always enjoy people's stories.
Take us back to the beginning of your creative career. Where did it all begin?
Well, I didn't have arty parents, and my parents separated when I was very young. So I lived with my dad and then stepmother, and we went down to the southwest in the countryside. But I had a grandmother who just was so clever. You know, she made all her own clothes, and she had a, you know, tailored suits for herself and knitted Farrell jumpers, made lace. And I just used to be fascinated by the detail that she was able to achieve. And I don't know, I sometimes think that I was born to be able to sew. You know, I can't remember actually when I started, but I think it's like a second language to me. I've always been able to see the detail and make whatever I want to make. It might take time to make in the way I see it, but I've always had the ability to just capture the details of things and find the right ways of making. I had fantastic school teachers, and one of which was a textile. She set up the first textile, what we call O-levels. It's the first, I said GCSEs now in the UK, when you're 16. And then I did A-level textile design. So I had this amazing beginning, you know, of a very early age. I sort of knew that I wanted to do something with textiles. It was sort of just ingrained in me very, very young. And I was very lucky, very inspirational. You know, we just did loads of printing and making things and sewing and drawing. It was just the most fantastic. And then I went and went to Farnham in Surrey, where I did textile design. I did a degree in textiles, and I was fascinated by the woven fabrics. You know, there's something about weaving where you're actually constructing a fabric is what sort of led me to making hats. I get very obsessed by things, and I was really obsessed by making fabrics to start with, and I got a Craft Council grant which bought an amazing Dobby loom. But I realized that very quickly that actually you can't just weave fabric, you know, and not expect to finance yourself. I didn't have any money, and I didn't have parental support or anything. So everything I've done in my life has been sort of driven by, well, how can I make money out of that? Because I've had to, you know, it's not like it's just a hobby that someone's paying me to do. There's always been, I've had to pay my rent, you know, I've had to find a way to live. So I realized very quickly that weaving wasn't necessarily the way ahead. And I didn't go and work for anybody. I just thought I could just do it myself, sort it out. I got a cheap flat in London and a studio. But it just, I couldn't find, you know, but even with my numerous part-time jobs, very difficult to make any money out of weaving. But then I started to get sort of interested in the structure of baskets and hats. I've always loved things that are self-contained, whether it be a basket or something that's just a beautiful shape. There's something very sculptural about hats and baskets. And so I kind of had to find how to learn. And there, at the time, there weren't any courses except for one at the London College of Fashion. So I sort of managed to get onto that because it was just with people from the factories up in Luton, you know, coming on their day release from the factories. So I did a very part-time course, you know, over a year, but it wasn't really that much time, with Marie O'Regan, who was the most extraordinary French lady, who was very strict and very knowledgeable and incredible skills. But I just thought, you know, I've got the basic skills. I thought, I can do this. You know, I can sew, I can block, I can do it myself. So I sort of set off on a very naive journey to think I could make hats and sell them. I've always been very lucky in that things seem to have popped up at the right time in my life that have given me a break. Or usually when I've been at rock bottom thinking, how on earth am I going to make a living out of this? And then something's always happened. So I had a friend that worked for the Mulberry Company, and he said, well, why don't you show your designs to the designers here? So I did, and I suddenly was designing a collection for them. But, you know, as with every milliner knows, you have to, you know, when you make things for shops, you have to sell at wholesale, and you have to pay for your fabrics up front. There's no, you know, unless you're a big company and you get 3 months credit, whatever, it's never really been like that with me. I've been very hand to mouth most of my life, really, with making and then selling. So, but that was, you know, once you get a brand like that under your hat, it's just a great stepping stone to the next thing. I suddenly got sort of rather overwhelmed and had quite a few orders with no money. And that's when I said to Bridget, why don't you join me? Because we've been friends for years, and I knew she was at a sort of junction in her life, and she was wanting to understand a bit more about hats. And so I said to her, well, why don't you join me? I've got all these orders and I need some help. And we sort of, I've always enjoyed her, her sense of humor and her, you know, amazing ideas, although she didn't have necessarily the hat making skills, which I, you know, it wasn't ideal having to show her how to sew Petersham's in the middle of the night, you know, because we were late on getting an order out. You know, it's hard to teach somebody when you're trying to finish an order. So, but, you know, we kind of managed, and within very long hours. And then that sort of led to other things. You know, we had Harrods and Liberties and Saks Fifth Avenue, and, you know, 30 shops or so we were selling to. But again, you know, really, it was fun, but really tough. And I kind of burnt myself out eventually. And I was never able to do the things I really wanted to do, because there was always a price tag on things, you know, that having to make for a certain price, you have to cost everything down to the, you know, the sewing in of the label, you know, it's a time consuming thing in itself when you've got 100 of them to put in.
And the Bridget you mentioned there is Bridget Bailey.
Yeah, Bridget Bailey, yeah.
We've done a podcast together, so yes. If anyone's interested in hearing what Bridget's up to now, that's a great way to find out. But what an amazing partnership.
It was, but, you know, it was tough. It was interesting. And, you know, looking back, I you know, you generally look at it with rose-tinted glasses, don't you, thinking, oh God, it was wonderful. You know, we were exhibiting at the London fashion shows and selling to Japan and going to Japan 3 times. It was a lot of hours of work and a lot of stress. And I don't really deal with stress very well. It took me a long time to realise that I was getting a lot of problems with my back and my hands, and also since 9/11, all the orders from America sort of just evaporated, really. So we were struggling. There wasn't really enough room for two of us in the business. And so I decided, it wasn't on a whim, I'd sort of, you know, when you reach a point, you think, I can't carry on. I just thought, I've just got to go. So I left her with the business and everything, because she wanted to carry on. I could hardly say, I want half of it, because, you know, she wanted to carry on. So, and I was in so much pain and difficulties with my back. I just needed to get away. It was a junction of, I thought maybe I would never return to making anything ever again, actually. Came down to the country, and I live in West Sussex with my husband, and we had dogs, and it was a sort of breathing space for me. It took me a number of years to kind of get myself back together. I think I went through all the other options of being a Pilates teacher to, I don't know, all sorts of things I was thinking that maybe I could do, but actually making things was what I loved. But, you know, seeing some exhibitions and reading about designers, I don't know, I think I just needed some time to regroup. And it was tough losing my identity. I really struggled with that, because I'd been, yes, part of a partnership and a hat maker and a well-known hat maker for a number of years, and to suddenly not have that was actually quite hard. I'm not sure how, I didn't really deal with it very well at the time. And I just got part-time jobs locally, just really unstressful ones in shops. I just wanted to do something where I'd get really bored. And then I'd be maybe inspired to think, come on, you know, you're going to have to. So I had to sort of buy everything again and start again. I had my flower tools. And that was it, really. So I sort of gradually got back into gathering hat blocks, and I hadn't really been making that many hats, because the flower side of it has sort of bloomed. And it's happened so gradually that it's hard to sort of explain how it all began, really. I've always been very much a sort of self-taught person, like I was with the hat making. I kind of have a way of working things out in my head. I can problem solve quite well, you know, in that I think outside of a problem, and I think about how be visual about the look of something. In my head, it sort of all kind of comes together. It can take a number of years sometimes for ideas to sort of formulate. And I have lots of things that are sort of half made and, but yeah, when I started again, it took probably about 10 years before I was properly back in the saddle.
How long was it between when you stepped away from the partnership? How long did you go without making for until you started to get that
about
buzz
five
to
or,
create
five or
again?
Six, 5 or 6 years. And then I just started very, very slowly, just, you know, really badly, actually, because I wanted to concentrate on the botanicals, and I was building a garden that was a wildlife garden, and I sort of became very interested in nature and conservation and pollination, and the fact we've lost 97% of our wild meadows. All these things kind of became apparent to me, that actually I just really want to study the flowers around me. And so I started, you know, looking at all the wildflowers and growing them and just picking things apart. You know, that was my textbook, really, just taking a flower apart, having a look at the colours, how it's constructed, how it actually works. You know, it's a sort of a whole wonderful process of how it sort of shows itself to a bee. You know, every flower is different. So I was just, you know, thinking about, I had a set of tools, so I sort of built on what I began with a very small set of tools, and I always, you know, really interested in textiles, so I had I bought some more dyes and fabrics, and I've always been a bit of a magpie, so I've got boxes of fabrics and antique ones, and so you know, it was just a very slow getting back into making again. I was very sad for a long time as well, because you know, leaving a partnership wasn't the easiest of decisions, and I felt sort of like I'd been wrenched away from what I knew and what I loved. But physically and emotionally, I just had to get away, really.
The churn of, particularly in a wholesale environment, like you mentioned, making for a particular price and then it maybe not being what your direction is you would naturally be drawn to, and responding to more of a brief scenario is a different game to play.
Yes. And I wanted to make the things I've always wanted to make to the degree of detail, because that's always been what I've loved. But because it was impossible to make that sort of thing for a hat and then sell. And that's always been the dilemma with hats, is that people don't necessarily respect the workmanship, because it's almost the last thing that someone buys when they're buying an outfit. The hat's the last thing that they buy. So I've always felt that there was a bit of a problem with, I couldn't make that amount of work that I wanted to make to go on a hat. So I started sort of specialising in just looking at flowers and looking at the detail and just giving myself the time to do it. In a way that I felt happy with, but that, you know, these things are not overnight successes, you know. Didn't someone say that overnight success takes 10 years? I think there is something definitely in that. People often see the final thing and they don't see what you've gone through to get to that. So I've, in a way, I've had to sort of say goodbye to the hat. Although what I'm enjoying these days are collaborations, and I'm working with Jane Taylor, who's a hat maker in London, and you know, because she's able to sell at a price, I'm able to sell her my flowers and still be happy with what I get for them. So we've got a wonderful thing going in just an aspect of what she does, but with her private clients and with royalty and the various other people that she makes for, we have a lovely sort of relationship that's based on trust and understanding of the lines of her hats are so beautiful, and they're very simple, that somehow my flowers seem to fit very nicely with that sort of couture feel. I've always been able to sew. I think it's just, maybe I could sew before I could talk. I don't know. My other job.
It is another language.
It probably would have been working in one of those couture houses doing very immaculate sewing. But I've never been very good at being told what to do. And I'm very much a sort of sensitive and, how do I put it? Sort of airy fairy, somebody once called me. just living in another world of imagination, just having so many ideas in my head and thinking I've already made them in my head sometimes, you know, I can almost see the final thing. So sometimes it's been the disappointing journey of actually putting what's in my head into the real thing when it's not coming out as I had imagined. Can take a few goes. Quite a few goes sometimes.
What is your process for that? So if you mentioned it starts as a creative thought.
I do draw, because looking at botanicals. I love botanical drawings and paintings and Dutch art, and I love the sort of detail of some of those illustrations and So I kind of work in that sort of way where I draw, I work out the colours. I have numerous sketchbooks where I store the ideas, the fabrics, whatever it is that I've picked up, and I put it all together. You know, it's just like a book of ideas. That nobody, I always say this to students, that, you know, a lot of people are afraid of drawing. And I said, well, don't think of it like drawing. Just think of it as ideas, you know, and you can pin them in your book, you can staple them in, you can draw things around things, you can collect postcards. It's just putting all the things in your head into a place where you can always refer back to something that you'd forgotten about sometimes. And so that's how I sort of begin. And a lot of sitting and staring, that happens a lot, but I guess some people call it meditation. But going for walks, you know, it's about problem solving. Most of what I do these days is about problem solving. Because I work with other people, I'm always being thrown, can you do this? Can you do that? Can you make that? So I kind of think, I'll just take the dogs out on the South Downs, and, you know, and often that's when an idea will come of how I can do that. So it's like a sort of magical moment of, oh yes, you know, why hadn't I thought of that before? Yeah, I think for me, it's especially in the early days, you know, money was such a problem. I can't emphasize that enough. And I, you know, you see this lots of milliners around, and they're having to sort of make for what I see are prices that aren't really high enough, you know, for the amount of work. When we were Bailey Tomlin, we were having most of the hats made in a factory because it was the only way we were able to sell to shops. Because if you handmade that and hand blocked and hand stitched the actual base of the hat, it would be impossible. Nobody would buy it. It would be like £1,000 in the 1980s, which would have been a ridiculous amount of money. So, you know, there's always been that, how can I do that? How can I sell that? My brain works in that way, I suppose, that it's all about, you know, as much as I love making the things that I want to make, I don't always have, I haven't had the opportunity for a few years now because I've been making the book and I've been working with other people. So actually my own work hasn't really, not really materialized. I've got some things going on, but I haven't had the time to finish them. But I hopefully will have a space of time where I can actually get some pieces of work together that are sort of about what I'm about. And they might be like 3D illustrations of nature, you know, that like a botanical drawing, but one that's come to life and coming off the page. But again, you see, I've got several things going on that are collaborations with embroiderers, with, I've been doing some things with a installation, they're called Magique in Paris, and they've been doing an installation on the perfume industry. So I've been making petals and elements of orange blossoms that they've been sort of blowing around in big domes, and then there's this sort of interactory thing where people can smell the smell as they press a button. And so that's going to Saudi Arabia, but I've got to remake all the flowers for that. So, you know, it's all very time consuming. And I've got, you know, some things with Lulu Guinness. I'm doing some flowers for her Hats for a big exhibition on Best of British. And yeah, there's lots of things in the pipeline that's stopping me doing my own work. And of course I teach. I think teaching's really important when you get to my age. But, or, you know, anyone that's been in this business for the time that we've been in it, there's lots to pass on. I think,
yes.
You know, when I was making things and when I started making hats, people were very secretive. And if I asked a question, often they'd say, you'd have to find that out yourself. I'm not telling you, that's my secret. So I didn't want to be like that, because actually I think if you give the same set of, which is what I've noticed, is that if you give the same set of materials and templates to 5 students, they'll all make that particular flower differently, because we all have hands and ideas and ways of making and stitching, they're all so individual. So you're always going to get a different outcome. So why would I be thinking and being precious about my ideas when actually no one's going to make it exactly like the way I've made it anyway? It's always going to, I mean, I hope that that's how people feel. You know, when I wrote the book, I wanted to write a book that was really a book that I would have found useful when I first started, because I couldn't find any books on the subject that weren't just sort of housewives in the 1950s type of books. Or later on, I found sort of Japanese books in Japanese and very sort of formulaic sort of ways of making that were very rigid, I found.
It really spells those Japanese books really are very specific and prescriptive about the combinations of materials, the dyes, the where the dye should be placed on the material.
But that's very Japanese, isn't it? They have their ways of doing things, and if you decide to go off course, that's not, you'd be told off probably if you were learning it. So I've never gone down that road, and I think there's, for me, this, my book was really about, you know, all, the way I put things together, showing people how you can look at different ways, different techniques, and make them your own, you know, just by, you know, looking at a tool, you know, think, I started with a set of tools thinking, well, what can I do with that? You know, it's a round shape. It's going to make a round, you know, it took me a long time because I didn't learn how to make it. So how to make flowers. I just found out how to make them just from experimenting, really, playing around. Well, I also looked around, of course. I looked to see what other people were doing, but I didn't always like what I saw. So, you know, in my head, I had this vision of how I could make things. And it's evolved, you know, the whole thing has just evolved. And I can't quite believe that I'm having this kind of late flowering at my age, and it's absolutely brilliant. You know, finally a culmination of where I've wanted to be really from the beginning, I finally sort of got there. Yes, I would like to have an opportunity to show my works in an environment that was just about what I did, but you know, I think that may come. You know, I feel, you know, I've been so busy with everything that's been going on with the commissions and the collaborations and the book and the teaching. There isn't much time for much else. And I think that life-work balance is really important. You know, you can't just work all the time. It's not very healthy. But I still love to earn my own money, and it's a driving force to have my own money. I've got a husband who, you know, also is a designer. But together we sort of live very simply, really, and we don't really go on holidays. My work sort of is my life, because I get up and I want to make things. You know, it's sort of part of the way I am. I've got some lovely young students that I'm really enjoying showing how to make things, you know, and I want to get them here to help them along, really. I think, you know, it's really important to give in life and to help people and just kind of to show them what I have to help with their sort of journeys. I think that's where teaching's so important.
How did the book come about?
I was asked, actually. I'd been thinking about writing a book because, as I said, I just felt there wasn't a book out there that was a book that I would have found useful when I first started. There isn't one. I've looked everywhere. So I was approached by a publishing company, Crowood, and I just said yes, you know, but I had absolutely no idea about how I was going to go about it, which is why it took so long. And then the pandemic happened in the middle of it, so that wasn't very helpful. In a way, it was helpful because I had the time just to get on with it. I really had to look at my process and how I made things, and it sort of really taught me a lot about myself. It was like digging deep into what I was about and how I work. I didn't find the explaining of it very easy. I'm not a writer, so I've had to learn that. Got a fantastic app called Grammarly that was brilliant because it just, you know about Grammarly, it's fantastic. It sort
I certainly
of
do.
Doesn't help you write, but it helps you present your writing in a way with the right punctuation. And you know, because my husband's a graphic designer and typographer, he was on the case as well. So together, we were able to get the writing bit together in a way that I felt comfortable with. You know, I didn't want it to be like a textbook, but I wanted it to be helpful and inspirational with lots of ideas that will show people that they can push those ideas somewhere else if they wanted to. You know, just showing all different ways of using tools and how to use dyes. You know, people are frightened of colour. I know they are. A lot of my students feel that. And, you know, messing around and being like you're in play school is something I always like to kind of instill in people because, you know, I think as you get older, you often are thinking of the final product rather than enjoying where you are. As we know, when you were a child, you'd just be messing around. You wouldn't be thinking about what was going to be the outcome. And I think we've forgotten that aspect of just messing around, you know, just see what happens. What happens if you put that colour with that colour? You know, and get a bit of fabric, paint a petal, see what happens. And that's how I learned, you know, just by trial and error. And, you know, one thing leads to another then. So it's nice to be able to sort of show a few of those things and how I work. And, you know, I've put the templates in the back and there's all the things about all the flowers that I've grown in my garden. And, you know, I love poetry, for instance. So there's a bit of poetry. There's a bit of thing about the actual flowers and you know, what they're useful for in nature. It's a whole combination of things, really. But that's, I think we all are a combination of our past, our things we're interested in. It's what makes people who they are, isn't it?
And in terms of capturing this all, is this something you did from your studio space or how did you do that?
I have a photographer who I've known for years. And he's a lovely man, very sensitive and really great with light. And so I asked him if he'd do the photographs. So I couldn't possibly have done them myself. You know, I think the publishing company were expecting me to do my own photos. And actually, I was a bit sort of perfectionist about how I wanted them to look. I think I'm making all the effort in the flowers. I need someone who knows what they're talking about to do the photographs, to give them justice, really. I didn't think I could give them justice. It would have been impossible. So I did have to pay quite a lot of money. And that's the thing about writing a book, is that even when you're not self-publishing, which I didn't want to do, you know, the great thing about having a publisher is that they're able to distribute the books, and I didn't feel I'd be able to do all that side of it. And also, I've got a really nice book. And you know, I've had to pay a lot of money out for the photography, but that's just life. It was never going to be a money spinner. It's more about, actually, one of the things I've really enjoyed is when I've been teaching and someone's asked me a question, I said, oh, just look at page 65. You know, I've really enjoyed that sort of being able to refer back to the book, and it's been wonderful to I've been imagining saying that for a long time. Just a bit of fun, really. You know, it's supposed to be fun, isn't it, what we all do? You know, it's a love, it's a passion, it's a driving force that gets me up in the mornings to think about what I'm going to be doing. But I do work alone and I actually love working alone, but where I don't work alone is in my collaborations, and that's a great way to have part of my time where I am working with somebody on an idea. And that's, I worked with a wonderful artist called Yinka Shonabare, who did these amazing sculptures, and he asked me to make several things actually, but mostly they're to do with the changing climate. So, it was perfect for me. Can you make, a branch of pine needles coming out of a dead tree? I've
Wow.
given, I know. So, it takes, days of just pondering and thinking before I even start. How do I do that? That's not going to be easy. But I love him and his ideas, and he's a really special man. And then he started giving me more and more difficult things and very rare flowers that I was unable to see because, of course, they're, for a start, they're rare. And I was having to look at images on Google. I mean, luckily, we have Google. I can look things up. It's fantastic. I do a lot of, I've always been good at research. If I do anything, I get on the computer and I find things out, and that's where that attention to detail comes from, I guess. It's all the same thing. It just goes into different areas of my life, I guess.
You mentioned about you're working alone in a space there. What is your studio space like?
I've got a huge big table. I've got lovely cabinets that my brother's given me recently, and tons of books. Books are my thing. I just think there's so much to gain from images and reading. And I've got a big magnifier area down the end, because some of the work I do is needs a bit of help, with it helps to sort of see the detail, like you're looking under a microscope at some aspect of a plant. I've got a massive collection of things. I collect, all sorts of old threads and eggs and feathers and, things that are, Bridget and I are very similar in that way. We always love nature and the sort of intricacies of nature. And how can you not sort of look at it with just wonder, And sometimes I think, what am I doing trying to replicate something when, and actually that's where it's not replication. And there, I have to differentiate between the real flower and what I'm making, because what I'm making is an interpretation. It's using fabrics for a start. I use a lot of paper clay. If I have to make a solid part of a flower, or different types of molding materials, that mean I can have like a. I've been making a rose recently where I've made a small vessel out of blocking over a giant flower ball tool. And I've been able to sort of mold it over, and then I've been able to put the smaller petals inside it and then the bigger ones around it. So, I use clay and these other materials as structure for the flowers. But it's all about looking at the real thing, but I'm thinking, I don't necessarily make every tiny detail, but I'm making the things that I think reflect that sort of personality of that plant. That what's that plant saying? What's it doing? And that's when I try to do my best with, it's exciting. It's really, really exciting. I'm making a hollyhock at the moment, which I've never made before.
Oh.
This is for one of Jane's clients, so she wants three
Yes.
stems of hollyhocks. I have no idea. I've been making the middles. It's not very easy, I don't have, they're not in flower, so I'm reliant on tons of imagery from Google. So I've been looking and looking and looking and looking at my books and drawing and working out the colors, and then it all comes together. So it can be a sort of couple of days of doing all that stuff, which actually can take a good amount of, it's like preparing for teaching. people think you just go in and teach. Well, actually, I spent 2 days getting all the fabric stiffened, all the templates ready, all the whatever I need to get ready for it. You know, it takes time. It's I like to do things well, and that's the sort of thing that I am my own worst enemy sometimes.
When did you begin teaching?
I began about 7 years ago, so quite a long time ago. I wasn't sure that it was going to be something I would enjoy, but I've really enjoyed it, and I have all kinds of students that have become friends, and I get all age groups. West Dean's a wonderful place, and I teach relatively regularly there, but I'm going to be teaching at Hand and Lock, the embroidery place in the centre of London. I've got a couple of courses coming up there, which I'm really looking forward to. I don't do that much teaching. You know, I do some one-to-ones in my studio. I don't teach big groups here because I've just taken over my room with all my stuff. It's just everywhere. Dyes and threads and half-baked things and all sorts of things going on.
It's a creative space.
I kind of can't believe my luck, in a way. That's how it sort of feels. I really didn't think that I would be able to have another life in this world. Although it's slightly different to before, it's still using skills that I've always had and being able to sell and make things and get people interested. And yeah, it's been a wonderful.
It's so interesting to hear the reflection because the approach of what you get to do now is so different to maybe it was what you were hoping. I'm not sure that's the right word. What you were drawn to initially, but that's not where you ended up in business, and you were drawn to the necessity, which we all have,
exactly,
to earn an income, and that's at that time that's how you were able to sustain your business for some years.
If I didn't have that necessity to earn, maybe I wouldn't have had the drive to make the things, and having the deadlines is the thing that moved me on. So if you don't have what's giving you that, you know, I'm having to earn money, so I've got to do this, you know, it's essential to sort of be part of the whole process of getting better at what you do. For me, anyway, I think if I was just given free rein and a rich husband, I'm not sure. I don't know. I mean, maybe I wouldn't have the same bulk of work and necessity to it's so exciting to sell things. You know, it's a wonderful exchange of somebody appreciating what you do, and then you've kind of birthed this wonderful hat, or and then it's left home and gone off to its owner. It's a wonderful process. And I will always make things to the best of my ability. And, well, these days, I'm afraid I have put a price on what I make. I've had to, and I've had this conversation with a lot of other milliners and people that make things. So, you know, unless we change the way things are, people will always expect to pay much less. You know, we have to respect ourselves to be able to be respected. And it's like setting a precedent, really, to, if you're going to put a cheap price on something, maybe someone thinks it didn't take you very long to make. And, you know, I've got 35 years of experience. That's got a value. I can remember, I think it was Jean Muir that said that. She said, you know, someone asked her how long something took her to make, and she said, 30 years, my darling. And it's true that, you know, the experience is valuable, and so it should be, really. So I mostly get turned down because I think, well, I'm not going to make that for less than that. I'm just not interested. I get a lot of people wanting things really quickly as well, and I can't do that. So I get I do turn down quite a lot of work. that comes my way. I only want to do the things I'm interested in now and work with people I really like. But, you
but
know.
That takes 35 years of
experience
to.
Exactly. I wouldn't be
And
able
that's a
to.
Practice thing as well. It can be very challenging as a creative freelance to say, that job's not for me. Maybe I'm not the right maker for this project.
Yeah, and I'll always pass it on to somebody who I think would enjoy doing that. I think it's important to be generous with our skills and generous with helping people and, you know, passing things on. It's really important.
What's a project you've got in the works at the moment that you're
I'm doing,
working away at
I've
or
got to get
looking
some
forward to?
roses together for Lulu Guinness's handbag in an exhibition. I'm doing the hollyhocks for Jane. I've got to remake all the Paris flowers. And amidst all that, I'm hoping to do some of my own pieces of work. I'm really interested in the sort of life and death of plants, which I started quite a long time ago, where I was making the life history of a dandelion. It started years ago, and it's a piece of work that I have since sold. And I love that whole process of the flower from seed to death. So it is a sort of an idea that I have for, you know, developing some things in my own work. But also, I haven't completely said goodbye to hats. And, you know, one of the favourite pieces I made is it's sort of based on a sort of on weaving in a way, because I wove some antique straw, you know. So I'm really interested in, with it had a sort of spray of Lily of the Valley on it. It's in my book. But I'm that idea, I think, has got quite a long way to go. And the other problem I have with hats is the quality of the straws nowadays are just not what they used to be. And I just love the vintage straws. So I search in charity shops for them, and I've got boxes of them. So I'm going to use some of those because they are utterly beautiful. But also, I'm going to carry on with my weavings of, you know, putting wire between tiny braided, you know, the old palea straw, and hand stitching. You know, there's something about the hand stitch that's can't be replicated with a machine. I think it's why I'm so attracted to embroidery as well. I've got masses of embroidery threads, old threads, and I will use them in, it's another project, flowers and embroidery on something really special. You see, it goes back to, you know, the couture things that I see. You know, looking at the old Christian Dior exhibition and that wonderful miniature dress that was covered in flowers, I just thought, God, I could do something so lovely. I've no idea whether it would be a worn thing, but it could certainly be something that could be a piece of some sort. Maybe it's just to be in a frame or something, but I don't know. There's so many ideas. The trouble is, I'm not sure of them, and they cram my head sometimes, and I end up getting back pain because I think all my focus has gone into my head and I'm having to think a bit more about my body. I've been struggling with a bit of back pain, and I've, you know, sometimes you have to stop and just relax. I'm really not very good at that. What do you do with an overactive brain? I don't know.
It's that, I think that's so interesting to hear how you document it, and it's about getting it out somehow.
Oh, it has to come out.
Recording
otherwise,
that idea in some way, whether it's a scribble, a sketch, a photo that prompts a memory of an idea. That's so important as well to give you that headspace.
Definitely, because I think things that happen in our heads, and, you know, people say quite a lot how they don't know how to start something. And I think at that beginning, that starting of an idea is so hard. It is the toughest point. But actually, just get started. You know, even if it's in your sketchbook where you're maybe gathering a few fabrics together or doing a scribble or finding a leaf that you like the look of or whatever it is, just put it all together and then shut the book. No one has to see what you've done. That's the great thing about a sketchbook. It's sort of, it's secret, isn't it? It's a bit like a diary that you can, like a visual diary.
External dump of the brain.
But you know, I just feel extraordinarily lucky, and I, you know, a day doesn't go by where I just feel quite blessed with being able to do the things. I don't know how I do the things I do. I just have an ability, and I'm just making the most of it whilst I can.
And sharing it so beautifully.
I still see these amazing, well. Yes, exactly. But I still have these visions of these amazing things in my head. So yeah, some of those have to, especially the hats. See, the hats are really special. They are just extraordinary conversation starters, I think. You know, I love really beautiful hats, but I also like really quirky ones. You know, Stephen Jones is so very good at that. Things that just say something or have some kind of conversation beginner. You know, I made a sort of 8 years ago a hat that has sort of based on Mary Poppins, which I adore that film. I've loved it since I was a kid. And I just wanted to make a robin, and I started sort of finding a way of fraying the silk and making an armature underneath it. So it's just finding ways to recreate an effect, but done really well. And, you know, that's what I've been blessed with, is that ability to sew and to make in great detail. But I don't, you know, it's not just about pretty flowers. You know, when I say I make flowers to people, I think they probably have this idea of just making fake flowers. You know, it sort of has a horrible connotation. Yes. It's not that. It's sculpture. It's problem solving. It's making something that's beautiful. It's taking what I see as millinery flowers to another level. You know, because when you look at the flowers that were made perhaps from many years ago, you know, the factories that occasionally they still make them, but you know, they're stamped out, they're not hand painted, they're all glued together. I still use stitch. I think it's important. I do use glue, but using stitch as well, and tiny bits of embroidery, and just take it to another level of, and the detail. How do you get those fine lines? You know, how do I find ways of overlaying fabrics? You know, where I made a butterfly where I used a whole range of fabrics that were sort of bonded together and stitched and layered, and just to create that sort of iridescent look, but also not just one flat fabric. And I think that's the thing that I see so often in millinery flower making, is that they're having to make them quickly because of the price of selling the hats. And that's the argument with flowers and hats. You know, that's my dilemma with the whole combination of those two things. But actually, my love is to make things really beautifully, and I can't help myself. Even if sometimes when I'm making for Jane, I spend far too long on it, I can't let it go without it looking really special. So I do always put in the extra mile just to make it look as good as I can. But, you know, the beauty of teaching, you know, having a flat piece of fabric, making that come to life, is the best thing I feel when I'm showing people how to make a flower. You know, this thing just emerges off the paper. It's a 3D suddenly from being a flat piece of fabric. It's a wonderful thing. And the use of colour, layering of colour, is something that I've really worked on. That again sort of brings the whole thing to life, I think. So although millinery flower making, I didn't want to call my book that, because you know, it's not really. I think there's ideas that people can use
yes.
to make their own flowers. But I think, you know, making the flowers to this degree of detail and then selling, you know, it depends how much you get for your hat. But I think probably simplification of what I do would have to happen, I guess. But that's the whole point, is that, you know, you can look at what I do and think, oh, I'll do that slightly differently, or I'll use just one layer of fabric, or, oh, I like the way that is. I mean, I do that with things that I look at. Sometimes I think, oh, damn it, someone's done something that I thought of, but I hadn't made. But what can I do to still do what I was thinking of, but not to look like somebody else's work? And that's really important, that you don't look like somebody else's work. You might take an element of the thing that you kind of admire and then turn that into something else. So it's not the feeling of the thing, it's where you're taking it to, I think, is the most important aspect of that. You know, we can't help but be influenced by what we see, but there's no point in replicating what somebody does because someone's already doing it. So there's no, what's the joy to be had or from making what someone else has already done? I think, you know, this book is, you know, have a look at what I do, but think, oh, I'll have a see how else I can do that. That would be my advice to anybody with anything, really. You know, we have to make things our own to bring our own personalities into and have that sense of achievement in having a sort of, it's like a light bulb moment, isn't it? When you think, oh God, that's fantastic. I love how that's come together. That's, and generally it's just from playing around. And you know, yeah, you might start by doing it in the way that someone's like in my book, start with that and then see where it takes you, because probably it will take you somewhere else. If you let yourself, let the ideas come in without being too restricted by what other people are doing. Just let the ideas come through. It's always my advice.
Thank you so much for joining me for this episode of Millinery Info. It was wonderful to welcome Anne to the podcast. Thank you to our podcast sponsors for their support of this episode and the series. Millinery Australia, Hat Academy, Hats by Lico, Judith M. Millinery Supply House, Be Unique Millinery, Lifted Millinery, Hatters Millinery Supplies, The Hat Magazine, House of Adorn, Louise McDonald Milliner, and Hatblocks Australia. I hope you've enjoyed this episode. If this is one you loved, I invite you to share it with a millinery friend, even someone who might enjoy textile art or flowers. I hope you've enjoyed this episode. Thanks so much for joining me. I look forward to talking hats with you again soon.